Thank you very much for listening in to our podcast series. I'm James Bowen, a Managing Associate in the Litigation, Arbitration and Investigations team at Linklaters. And I'm joined by my colleague, Jasmine Olamalaye, and a special guest, Jemas Hodevala KC of Matrix Chambers. Today, we'll be interviewing Jemas on environmental crime and money laundering, with perhaps some tricky questions on sanctions towards the end. This is an underappreciated area of risk for UK companies and is only going to get more salient as the focus on the E of ESG increases. Ultimately, if your business is involved with or benefits from environmental crime overseas, however indirectly, there is a risk of criminal liability in the UK, as well as significant reputational risk. Now, with that scary introduction, we'll move straight into the interview. So, Jemas, starting with an easy question, we'll just go through the kind of current legislative framework in the UK. So could you perhaps talk us through the current position in the UK on environmental crime and money laundering, and what offences might be implicated if you had environmental crime in your supply chain overseas?
Yeah, sure. So there's two ways to break it down, I suppose. The first is to say that environmental offending operates territorially. So offences, waste offences, for instance, under Section 33 of the Environmental Protection Act 1990, regarding treating, keeping, disposing of waste, operates territorially. Then you've got the regime under the Environmental Permitting Regulations 2016 that deals with the requirement for permits to operate regulated facilities. And that in itself has got various criminal offences if you either don't have required permit when you should have one, or if you're breaching the terms of your permit.
But those are UK-specific offences,
they're UK-specific offences. Now, where it becomes interesting is when you look at the Proceeds of Crime Act 2002 in the UK and the definition of criminal conduct in Section 340, because Section 340 operates extraterritorially. So there's, again, two ways to look at proceeds of crime. The first is to say if you have offending overseas, if you have a criminal offence overseas that would also amount to a criminal offence in the UK, then it's criminal conduct. It's capable of being criminal conduct for the purposes of money laundering. Where it becomes more complex is where you have conduct that's perhaps poorly regulated overseas, or even maybe legal overseas, such as environmental offending, which would be offending in the UK but is lawful overseas. Now, what happens in that situation? As I say, it's more complex.
Well, there is an exception in the POCA, isn't there?
There is, yes. So where you have an offence or conduct that would be an offence if it took place in the UK, but is lawful overseas, but if it occurred in the UK, it would merit a sentence of more than 12 months, then it is effectively criminal conduct. So companies may find themselves in a situation of operating overseas, having supply chains overseas, where there's no legislation that precludes or criminalises particular conduct, and focus on that, whereas actually what they should be focusing on is whether the conduct that's occurring overseas would amount to an offence in the UK.
And that's quite a challenging point to work out, isn't it? Especially for environmental offences.
Incredibly. Incredibly complicated. And this is a really timely podcast, really, because there's a growing awareness of the disparity between unethical conduct and unlawful conduct. And really what's becoming increasingly prevalent now is realising and appreciating that environmental offending and various other forms of offending aren't simply unethical. There comes a point where they tip into the unlawful, and unlawful specifically for the purposes of proceeds of crime legislation.
Yes, and I think there's a JR case that we'd talked about prior to this podcast, the World Uyghur Congress one. Do you want to touch on that one briefly?
Yes. So related to modern slavery in supply chains, but interesting case, very interesting case, which is going to appeal in May this year. And I think it's interesting for a whole host of reasons, but principally because the NCA and HMRC conceded that products that had been made using forced labour were capable of amounting to benefit from criminal conduct for money laundering purposes. The issue in that case was firstly evidential, because the claimant struggled to demonstrate on the evidence that a particular batch of clothing, t-shirts, shirts, jeans, whatever, had actually been manufactured using slave labour. So you couldn't simply say generically as a claimant or as a prosecutor, you've imported these products from...
Yeah, you have to be able to identify the specific criminal property.
That's it, exactly. So that was the first issue. The second issue that is particularly interesting from environmental crime as well is the calculation of adequate consideration, because you've got three different offences under money laundering legislation. You've got section 327, 328, 329. Only section 329 has a defence of adequate consideration. So in other words, if you use, possess or acquire criminal property, you have a defence if you can show that you've paid adequate consideration for the particular criminal property, which may seem bizarre to some people to hear that you can actually acquire criminal property if you pay sufficient interest.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Because otherwise it would be tainted forever into whoever's hands. And that's
absolutely
just ludicrous.
Absolutely, yes.
Sorry, please, I interrupted your flow. Go on.
Well, no. So why it was so interesting in the Uyghur Muslim case was because there is a debate and was a debate at the time. If you have adequate consideration that effectively operates on the goods to cease them having a criminal origin or criminal quality, that creates a market in goods that have been manufactured using slave labour. And there's all kinds of ethical and legal connotations around that. And then if you apply that case to what we're talking about today, which is environmental crime, similar sorts of issues apply. If you're a company and you, for instance, you've acquired illegally mined gold and you've paid market rates for illegally mined gold, well, does that mean that you have the defence under Section 329 or not? You know, many would say that you do on the current state of the law.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, is there any scope for you to be charged with a Section 328 offence there, and that you're facilitating the retention by whoever you're purchasing things from of their criminal property, albeit converted into the cash that you paid for that illegally mined gold?
Absolutely correct. So that was one of the issues in the Uyghur Muslim case, that the NCA and HMRC, their position was supply chain cases, our offence of preference would be Section 329. So the case didn't really look at all the nuances created by Section 327 and 328, but maybe that's going to be something that's examined on appeal.
Maybe it is just that it's not quite cast right at the moment. But in any case, perhaps we can move on a little bit from the minutiae of the law to who really faces risk from this. What type of companies are affected by this, and who should be worried about it the most?
So I think it's very difficult to identify particular industries or sectors that are going to be affected by environmental crime and supply chains and those that aren't. I mean, I suppose just off the top of my head, there are some pretty obvious sectors that would be affected or likely to be affected. So, for instance, you've got the manufacturing sector, you've got companies that are involved in the transition to net zero, so EV vehicles, for instance. Then you've got technology companies, electrical companies that are using rare earth minerals, gold, that kind of stuff in their products. And then the mining industry as well would be an obvious example. But then it's a question of those sectors being impacted by environmental crime. How does that then play out in supply chains?
Well, exactly. It's not just the primary recipients of the illegally mined gold or the improperly produced rare earth metals or whatever it might be, but it's also everybody whose products those go into, right?
Correct, yes. And so your mobile phone might have thousands of different components that have been garnered from dozens of different countries using hundreds of different suppliers. Does that mean that you don't need to comply with POCA legislation when you put that phone together or when you sell that phone? I would suggest probably not. You know, everybody needs to comply with UK Proceeds of Crime legislation.
I suppose so, but then there is the requirement around knowledge or suspicion, isn't there? And
correct.
If you're that many steps removed, you know, how many steps are there between the manufacturer of a mobile phone, perhaps in Shenzhen, and the artesian coltan mine in the DRC, which no doubt has environmental issues associated with it.
Yes.
And I suppose the issue is how far up the supply chain you go.
Yes. And I think the reality is that most companies probably haven't had environmental crime on their radar historically. And it's been certainly less on the UK government's radar. You know, the UK National Money Laundering Risk Assessment, for instance, includes waste crime, but it doesn't really involve the sort of environmental crime that we're talking about
now. It's
quite
parochial, yes. Domestic UK crime, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. So what we're talking about now is sort of transnational crime, which is widely recognised. Interpol, for instance, has recognised this as being one of the most lucrative crimes on the planet, just because it's a high reward and low risk crime for organised criminals to move into. So the question about industries that are affected by this, I think there are a number of companies out there that would be well advised to look at risk assessments with regards to environmental crimes in their supply chain.
That's very fair. If it's all right, I might hand over to my colleague Jasmine now to pick up some of the more specific points around the problems that businesses face.
So, Jamas, if you were running a business exposed to this, what would be keeping you up at night?
Well, I think your question is really interesting, because what would be keeping me up at night is if I hadn't appreciated the risks in the first place, but I was listening, for example, to this podcast and now gradually becoming aware of what the risks are. So I think, again, the reality is that many, many companies that should have this on their radar don't. So my first concern would be not understanding the risks to my business from environmental crime in supply chains. The second concern that I'd have that would be keeping me up at night is not really having an appreciation or understanding of when unethical becomes unlawful under proceeds of crime legislation. And then the third thing that would be keeping me up at night is something that is becoming increasingly perhaps not prevalent, but increasingly used, and that sort of whistleblowers evidencing criminal conduct, environmental criminal conduct in supply chains, and also something called a GLAN notice, which we'll touch on very briefly, but it's effectively NGOs that are starting to compile dossiers of evidence, which they then submit to executive boards that put the board on notice, as it were, for knowledge or suspicion purposes, that there is environmental crime in supply chains.
And so, aside from not listening to our podcasts before you go to sleep at night, what else? What would you do about it?
So I think it's really important that companies and general counsel start to get ahead of the curve. So it's appreciating that there is this issue in supply chains. So first of all, educating themselves with regards to what environmental crime is would be the first thing. Second thing would be to risk assess your supply chains and apply the understanding of environmental crime in that risk assessment. Third thing would be to conduct appropriate due diligence with regards to environmental crime. So there's a lot of EU legislation that's currently implemented or on its way regarding due diligence, and we're sort of moving more towards a due diligence model, so conducting appropriate due diligence to all of this. And then fourthly, I'd suggest remediating where there are found to be issues in supply chains involving environmental crime. Now, of course, that may involve working with suppliers to remediate the environmental crime itself. So, for instance, making sure that suppliers obtain the requisite permits in Indonesia or Venezuela or wherever it may be. But in some cases, it may well be remediating that involves changing your supplier. And that can be pretty hard for a company to do at relatively short notice.
And so at the outset then, and also if you're thinking about changing a supplier, you mentioned due diligence there. Is that something that companies should always be carrying out as a matter of course? Or is that something you only need to think about if there are certain red flags or suspicions already?
I think, again, historically, due diligence in environmental crime has been way down the list of priorities. Certainly, you know, fraud, bribery, corruption, that sort of thing, due diligence has been far higher up the agenda. The reality is that nowadays supply chains are global, and I think it would be a brave company today who decided that they weren't going to conduct any due diligence in relation to environmental crime, given the trajectory that we appear to be going in towards environmental crime being a relevant offence for money laundering purposes in the UK?
I mean, certainly in our practice, in M&A transactions, when we're sort of doing the kind of compliance advisory piece around those, you do see more and more environment-focused questions than you would have seen even 5 years ago.
Regarding the existence of permits,
exactly.
Permits, that sort of thing, yes.
Whereas ABC has always been in there.
Yeah.
The two things that have popped up recently have been environmental crime and have been sanctions.
Yeah.
So when the companies have received their information, then can they take as given the information provided by a supplier? Or do they need to carry out further analysis to verify the truth of the information they've been given for themselves?
I think companies need to operate in a similar way to their existing risk assessments. So, for instance, if you asked a supplier whether they had bribery in their business operations and they told you no, would you necessarily accept that? I suspect you well, maybe you would, I don't know, but maybe you wouldn't. And I think environmental crime is no different. Given that money laundering legislation over here requires you to have knowledge or suspicion of the offence that's actually occurring, there may be a temptation amongst companies to sort of shut their eyes and close their ears to what's happening in their supply chains. But I think that'd be a rather myopic approach, really, to the issues that we're talking about today. So I think it really depends. How reliable is the information that you've been provided with? What are the, is it credible evidence? Has it been evidence? So if a supplier says that there is no criminality in their supply chain and they produce evidence to demonstrate that, fantastic, you can probably rely on that. But otherwise, I think caution should be urged.
So we might just touch then on the Economic Corporate Crime and Transparency Act. And I'm very glad to hear that you are aligned with me in advocating for adoption of ECTA.
Absolutely.
As an abbreviation. But I do understand others are violently opposed. So using its full title to put the question to you, the Economic Corporate Crime and Transparency Act has brought in corporate liability for money laundering offences. How will this impact money laundering offences for environmental crime?
So I think, again, it's premised on the fact that environmental crime is something on the ascendancy in terms of interest for corporates. And the answer is, whilst the Section 196 corporate liability has money laundering as one of its predicate offences, so in other words, senior managers who conduct or who commit money laundering offences can now render the entire corporate liable for money laundering. The same provisions don't apply to the failure to prevent offence. So money laundering is not a failure to prevent offence in ECTA, but it is for corporate criminal liability. And I think that's going to be interesting because you increasingly see corporates engaging people in roles such as supply chain managers or product managers. And there may be a debate about whether those sorts of people are senior managers for the purposes of ECTA when it comes to money laundering offences and environmental crime in the supply chain.
And that senior manager's term will be quite familiar to many people in financial services, for example.
Yes,
how closely do those concepts align?
Well, I was just going to say the guidance has so far been that the financial services definition of senior manager is different to the definition of senior manager that we've got in ECTA now. So I think really when the Law Commission first proposed senior managers, it was more looking towards a sort of health and safety definition of senior manager. And I think there's been further guidance that's now come out with regards to how prosecuting authorities and the government will look at senior managers. So I think this is it's a relatively new area for companies. And you know, many would be well advised to sort of look at all these issues holistically.
Thank you, that's really helpful and some quite practical guidance there. In the third final section of the podcast, I think James is going to take us through some questions around future developments and forwards.
So, Jamas, I'm going to ask you to do some crystal ball gazing now. I hope you don't mind.
Right.
Obviously, we've got the UN SDG deadline of 2030, net zero target for net zero deadline for 2050. Do you see enforcement appetite changing as a result of these? Do you see more pressure on states, the UK or elsewhere, to start being active on environmental crime? do you see a world where it stops being high reward, low risk, and perhaps becomes high reward, high risk? What do you think the enforcement appetite does in the next?
So I think the Western world is admirably, obviously, aiming for these net zero targets, transition targets, etc. I think there comes a point, though, where leaving it to private industry to achieve those really quite demanding transition targets is frankly unfair and unrealistic. And so the question is, what's the government going to do about it? Because ultimately, companies want to make profit, and a lot of this transition is going to involve additional costs, additional work, additional resources. So I think the UK government has already indicated in its critical imports and supply chain strategy that it's expecting transitions to occur without subjecting ESG criteria to any kind of denigration. So it's interesting that the UK government appears to have committed to a transition towards net zero without compromising these ESG goals and ESG targets. So I think with that in mind, assuming that any future government continues along the same trajectory, which I think it has to, I think it's almost inevitable that we're going to get to a stage, perhaps not tomorrow or perhaps not this year or perhaps not even next year, but relatively soon, where the government starts taking the view that actually it can't just simply sit by and hope that things work out for 2030 or 2050. There is going to be increased regulation in this area, because otherwise there's going to be Pyrrhic targets that are set, and there's going to be a vastly unlevel playing field around the globe. And so something's going to have to be done about it.
That's a very fair point. And picking up levelling that playing field and applying pressure overseas around environmental crime, should we expect Magnitsky-style sanctions against those who commit environmental crimes? I mean, to what extent are we already seeing those? I know there are sanctions in place around Myanmar teak, for example, although I think those are human rights driven versus being specifically driven by environmental crime. Do you see a world where in 5 years, as well as potential carbon border tariffs, we also have sanctions imposed on the worst polluters?
That really is crystal ball gazing. do I think it's going to happen? Well, look, I think to an extent the US has already started debating this. I mean, whether these kinds of Magnitsky-style sanctions legislation is going to get through Congress, I suspect probably not at the moment. But having said that, you can see very easily that we are now sort of diverging as a planet into countries that have resources, rare earths, that are going to be essential, critical minerals that are going to be essential for the transition to net zero. So those countries, and the countries that need those minerals to transition to net zero. And not all of the countries that need the minerals are going to be playing by the same rules, I suspect, without naming any names. You know, there's some obvious actors in that sense, aren't there? So I can see the requirement for rare earths and the finite supply of rare earths, finite resources, being something that Western world increasingly competes over. And if you're increasingly competing over limited resources, it does seem to me that possibly sanctions are going to be one possible area where these sort of green sanctions can play out.
And there are, of course, other measures which fall short of that. So, for example, it's quite interesting. You may have seen last week that a whole load of cars were stopped at the US border because of components that apparently contained the products of forced labour. And you could see, you know, measures falling short of full-scale asset-free sanctions, but those kind of things, and a bit more of a sharp-elbowed approach to achieving geopolitical goals around access to minerals and trying to mitigate the harm done by the extraction of those minerals overseas.
Yes, I think the Uyghur Forced Labour Prevention Act in the US is a really good example of how reversing the burden of proof on importers has really worked quite well without going so far as imposing sanctions on China in that sense. But of course, there's been retaliation from China. It has, in the not too distant past, impose export restrictions in relation to gallium and germanium. You know, these are critical minerals required for chips. And so...
And obviously an interesting thing about those, and forgive me for breaking in slightly, is that it's not, my understanding is, it's not that they're rare in the absolute, it's just that they're present in a lot of places in very, very low concentrations. And the process of extracting them is so environmentally damaging that the Western world has been quite happy to outsource it to particularly China for the last 20 years and is now going...
Regretting that decision.
Yes. But then how do you square that circle of we need these for the green transition, but also the reason that we haven't built a rare earth minerals industry in our backyard is we don't want that kind of thing happening in our backyard.
Mm. Well, the EU is leading the way now in terms of legislation. So there's the Critical Minerals Act, which the EU is implementing with a view to shifting supply chains away from China to other areas. And also, the UK's critical import and supply chain strategy is designed to or intended to move away from reliance on China and develop new supply chains for these critical minerals that are needed for the transition to net zero.
Yeah, without compromising on ESG standards.
Without compromising on ESG, that's the thing, absolutely. So you can very easily see an unlevel playing field opening up very quickly. And the question, coming back to your question about sanctions and green sanctions, do I think that that's something that may happen in the future? Well, absolutely. Do I think it's something that's going to happen tomorrow? No, you know, because there are various other, I think sanctions are going to be a last resort rather than the other sort of, as you described them, sharp-elbowed measures that may be implemented before we get there.
Thank you so much. And actually, thank you very much for drawing my slightly rambling question back to such a succinct conclusion. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. So I think we'll draw to a close there, but thank you so much for joining us to answer our questions today on environmental crime. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, and I hope that you've enjoyed the discussion as much as we have.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure, Jamas.
For anyone looking for further resources on the topics we've touched on today, you could find our Economic Corporate Crime and Transparency Hub on the Linklaters website.